Good morning, everyone. Good to see those of you that are here. I do want to say as well, kind of taking on what Ellen was talking about earlier with the kickoff and stuff. If there's anyone, first of all, we'll start with this. At the kickoff, we a lot of times think, well, there's inflatables and there's cotton candy and there are, you know, these games and stuff, that it's for kids. So you bring your kids and your grandkids and those kind of things, nieces, nephews. But it is for everyone. It is a kickoff that everyone is invited and encouraged to be a part of. And so there are things to do. Everybody eats food, right? So you have to eat that night. Well, maybe you don't, but you should eat that night. And so we've got lots of free food and lots of free things to do. The kids can run around, grandkids can run around. But I just encourage everyone. I think it'll be a really neat community event to bring people together, hopefully bring the neighborhoods together a little bit more, to be able to just have a fun time, a good time, and just spend time together. And so that's, I like doing things. Maybe you don't like seeing me, that's fine, but I like seeing you guys. I like chances to get together. I like chances to hang out, hear more about what's going on in your life. And if we don't meet together, if we don't get together, we lose some of those chances. We lose some of that opportunity to encourage and uplift one another. And so I want to encourage you to keep that in mind, the kickoff on the 21st. But also, if you want to come and you want to participate a little bit more, we could use some help just kind of overseeing the games or kind of having like a little stop sign for the kids to go on the inflatables. Because if we just open up the inflatables, the kids will just kind of, you know, they'll just live there, basically. They'll move in kind of a thing. And so we just need to have people that will help them get through or to run the other games. So if you're interested and able to help for that, just let me know sometime between now and then. As we get started, I've got a few little... Oh, sorry, go ahead. Or someone to wash dishes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, even if you don't want to... Yeah, you can wash dishes. If you don't want to interact with anybody, that's a way to go, too. So, no, I'm just kidding. That's it. That's a great help for sure, too. Any way that you can get involved. Yes, thank you, Ellen. Okay. Wanted to start with some images this morning, things to think about. If you can't read them, I'll try to read them to you. But this is about, we're talking about address this mess. And so these were some messes that I thought were interesting. And it says, if you can't read it, it says there are better ways to log off. And so those of you that have worked with computers for very long, I relate to him. So that probably is. It says pick two. I'll give you just a second. On the top it says your sanity. On the one side is happy kids, and the other side's a clean house, and you get to pick two. Hold on, Tom, go back to that one just a second. I want to let that last one linger just a second. Because I sat and I looked at that for a while, and I was like, that is true. You really only get to pick two. You are either sane and have happy kids, or you're sane and you have a clean house, or you have happy kids and a happy house. There's just no way to get all three. I don't. Anyway, if someone has it figured out, let me know. All right, go ahead. That's fine. I think most of the moms would probably agree with that, right? Love cleaning up messes I didn't make. You didn't agree with that? Oh, okay. I like this one. It says, my house is not a mess. It's just that everything is on display for your viewing pleasure, like a museum. It's a good way to look at it. I like that one. And this one's probably my favorite. It says, don't try to clean up that mess. It would be easier to get some boards and build a filing cabinet. Just build it around it. Sometimes it feels like the way to deal with a mess is just to build a filing cabinet around it. So anyway, I want you to think about this morning, as we kind of wrap up this series on Address This Mess, your biggest mess, right? Maybe you dropped a big jar of something, of salsa, and as soon as it hit the floor, it seemed to just hit the ceiling and the walls and everywhere, right, all over the place. Or maybe you spilled paint, right? And so you're painting the walls, and you spill this paint, and you decide, well, the carpet needed to be painted too, right? So you just brush it in, because it's almost impossible to get that out if you spill enough of it. And you just think about your biggest mess, right? Some of this mess. We have, with our newborn, I'm reminded that when they have some kind of issues, digestive issues, that sometimes you get a little brown coming up the back. I don't know. Do you guys, that's maybe too gross for us this morning, but you guys, most of you that are parents, understand that, I think. And my answer to a lot of that is, let's just throw everything out. Let's just take the onesie off, we'll just throw it all out. It's not worth trying to clean it out. But my wife tells me that's too expensive to do, so I let her clean it up. But anyway, I know, right? Anyway, she likes to do those things. That's what I tell myself. Anyway, so we're finishing up our series on Address This Mess, about how we how we have messes in our life, and we talked a couple weeks ago about how we have this standard, these shoulds, these oughts, this idea that nobody's perfect, right? This perfection that's out there, but nobody attains to it. And so we talk about this, and we have this standard, and we continue to fall short of that standard. We said the first week that we can look at each other, we can look at our own mess, and we can start to see there's some common ground, because I know a mess when I see one because I am one. I know a mess when I see one because I am one. And so we kind of get this commonality, this togetherness, and so as we draw together, as we bring together, we have that in common. Really, that mess is what brings us together. We have that community involvement with our messes, but also that same mess that brings us together is the same mess that brought God near. Because of our mess, because of our situation, God came close to us. And so as we worked through this, as we talked about it, and we looked at this and processed this, we wanted the quick fix. We wanted to get things done quickly. We were in the mess, and we were emotionally or physically or whatever, and just needed something to fix it. The problem is that's not how the real world works. There's not a quick fix for a lot of these things. And so instead of a quick fix, Jesus tells us to follow him. Quick fix is now. The follow me is a process. And so we have this mentality moving forward that we get in these messes, we get in these situations, and we need to follow him back out of them. And so again, I want you to think about your biggest mess, and instead of though thinking about a physical mess, paint spills, a jar explosion, or whatever goes up the back of the baby's back, but you know, instead of a physical mess like that, think about an emotional or a spiritual or a relational mess that you feel like you've been in. Whether it's one you're in now or one in the past, or maybe it's a financial mess where we borrowed money that we didn't know how we were going to pay back, or a relational mess where I said some things or she said some things that we didn't necessarily mean, but we were angry or we were frustrated or things weren't going the way we wanted to. And so all of these things cause a big mess. And with all of these messes, with all of this diversity, if everybody came up front, which I'm not going to make you do because that would be really awkward, but if you came forward and you shared that big mess, if I shared my mess with you guys, the one thing that we would have in common, and this isn't necessarily good news, but the one thing that we would have in common is that we all have the opportunity to make that mess worse. We all have the opportunity to make that mess worse. These bad options present themselves, and a lot of times it's that quick fix, it's that quick answer. Well, you know, she said that, and so, you know, but and I did something, and she found out, but I told a lie so that I could get out of it, so that things would kind of go back to normal. Or that money we borrow, well, we can't pay it back, so we're just going to borrow more money and more money. We try to fix it. We have these bad options. We send a second text message saying, just kidding. I was just kidding. You can ignore the first one. It was just a joke kind of a thing. I don't know. JKLOL. I don't know if I... Anyway. We get these opportunities to make that mess messier. We get those opportunities. Those are available to us. And we see that in a story that we're all, I think most of us this morning are probably pretty familiar with, the story of a man that shows us, that expresses to us something and how this can look in real life. And so we're looking at the man named David. And David lived about 1,000 B.C., about 1,000 years before Jesus comes. And at that time, he's just a little boy. He comes into our pages. He comes into our world as a little shepherd boy. He eventually will become the greatest king of Israel. And I don't know if that's even arguable, the greatest king in Israel's history. But before he gets to that point, he's a little boy, the least amongst his brothers, the least among the people of Israel. Even his tribe is one of the least. And the prophet Samuel, if we want to turn to 1 Samuel, he's the prophet that we're going to be looking at. But Samuel comes into David's life, and he, through God's direction, through God's leading, anoints David as the next king of Israel. The problem is there was already a king. There was already a king of Israel, and that's Saul. And so that's really where the story begins. And like I said, most of us know this story. We start with the anointing of David, but then quickly we get into the story of where Israel is fighting with the Philistines, and they're constantly at war. They're constantly fighting and struggling in that area. And Israel and the Philistines, their battles will kind of pop up here and there. And in one particular battle, they're entrenched. They're kind of at a standstill, and David is sent by his father to bring his brothers supplies, food, and those kind of things to the Israelite camp. And while he's there, he hears the taunts of the giant. The giant Goliath is taunting the army, telling them to send out their best soldier, send out their best person, and we'll fight one-on-one, and you will become our slaves if I win, and we'll become yours if you win. And so David, hearing the heckling, hearing the taunting, decides that to go against this giant isn't much different than slaying a bear or a lion, as he's done numerous times in the past. And so he goes out through God's miraculous hand to destroy the feared giant. And after this event, David's popularity soars. And my parents are here this morning. I remember, you guys remember that David video I used to watch all the time? Yeah, because that's just entrenched in my mind. Some things just stick in your mind for some reason. And I don't know that they were overly good necessarily, but they stuck in my mind. So, but I can still hear the women in the video calling out, coming out to David, coming back to the city, that Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. Everyone's talking more and more about David, which means they're talking less and less about Saul. And David, though, is given more and more opportunities, more and more authority, and leading Saul's army. In verses 12 and 13, Samuel writes to us here in chapter 18 that David is going to lead the troops into battle, and that's an attempt by Saul to get David away from him. Really, to probably even get him killed in battle. Because even right away, even right after this story, Saul starts to feel a little animosity towards him. And as David is successful in these military conquests, it says in verse 14 of chapter 18 that in everything David did, he had great success because the Lord was with him. Because the Lord was with him. And the more popular he became, the more and more popular he became. And people talked and gushed over him. And as he was more and more successful, we see in verse 15 that Saul saw how successful David was. And he was afraid of him. But all of Israel and Judah loved David because he had led them in their campaigns. And the more popular David became, the bigger problem that Saul had. And so just as most of us, I think, do, the more we feel we're losing things, the more we feel control is getting away from us, the more we try to grab at it. We try to seize it. We try to get a hold of whatever we can. And so Saul does this, and first again, it's sending David away, trying to get him killed in battle. Next, he tries to, this idea of keeping your friends close, but your enemies closer. And so he tries to bring David in to make it look like he's offering something wonderful to him, but really trying to keep an eye on him closely. And so he offers his daughter's hand in marriage. Offers his daughter's hand in marriage, and again, appears that he's coming alongside of David, but really, really still wants him out of the picture. But David is willing, or David, though he's honored, and it's something that's going to propel him in his status, he refuses that proposal, feeling that he's not honorable, not that he is from the lowest family in the lowest position possible, and doesn't deserve to be a part of the royal family. And so we see that David here is not only the valiant, he's the warrior, he's the leader, but we also see now that David is the humble. And as popularity increases more, Saul's problems increase more, and then something happens that seems to favor Saul. And one of his other daughters falls in love with David. And so the second daughter, Michal, is falling in love with David. Saul gets another plan, he gets another idea, and he grows it and develops it, amplifies it. Because in that culture, at that time, there was a bride price. And in my family, I would be in so much trouble if I had to pay, the bride price for, my family. Anyway, it would just be really expensive. So, in that culture, though, it was common for families to request a father to ask for something in exchange for their daughter. But for royalty, as Saul was royalty here, it wasn't necessarily animals or money, but it was more a proof of the son's or the future son-in-law's value or worth or ability. And so what Saul challenges for Saul or David to do, it shouldn't be a challenge, it's more of being able to pay for something, but it becomes a challenge, basically. And he challenges David to provide Saul with 100 Philistines, tokens, we'll call them tokens, 100 Philistines to be killed for his daughter's hand, and that wouldn't have been high. The number might have been unusual, but the act itself wouldn't have been unusual in that culture. It would have been showing David's ability and show David's worthiness to be a part of the family. And so in verse 25 of chapter 18, we see a glimpse into what Saul's hope and plan is in sending him out on this mission for his daughter. It says, Saul's plan was to have David fall at the hand of the Philistines. He wanted him to go out, even with his men and his army, to take out 100 Philistines, but his hope and his goal was that he would fall, that David would fall. And though we're not told why he decided to marry Michal, the second daughter, rather than the earlier daughter and her sister, he does accept this one. And we're not sure, again, why exactly. I have my assumptions, but we're not told explicitly why he accepts that offer, why he decides to marry that second daughter, because it never says that David loves Michal back. It just says that she loves him. And so he decides to accept this offer. He decides that I can do this, I'm going to take care of this and make her my wife. And so he goes out with his men, and not only does he find the 100 Philistines to kill, he kills double that and brings home 200, we're going to call them tokens. If you've got your text in front of you, you know what he's actually bringing back. But 200 tokens for the king. And actually, it's interesting to me that in front of the king, where is it? Yep, in front of the king, they count the tokens. And I wouldn't want to be a part of that counting process. But they're counting these tokens that David brings back for these 200 Philistines. And ultimately, we see in David's success in defeating the Philistines that he is able to take Michal as his bride. And we read in verses 28 and 29, chapter 18, when Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that his daughter Michal loved David, Saul became still more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy for the rest of his days. We see Saul's attempt to grab control, to seize some kind of a semblance of control in this situation, the more he seems to fall into trouble, the deeper and deeper he seems to fall. So Saul's in a pretty big mess. But if we look at this from David's perspective, when we look at it from David's side, he's in a big mess too. He's in a situation where he's in a mess, but it's a mess that he didn't create. He didn't make choices that fell him into him. He was just a shepherd boy when Samuel came to anoint him. He was just serving his country when he went out and slayed the giant. He was just doing his duty when he was advancing the army, when he was being successful in these military campaigns. He was just doing what he knew to do best. It was a mess he didn't create, and just as it seems like everything's going to come and fall into place and everything's going to just blow up, finally Saul makes his kind of a final choice to kind of push everything over the edge. And he tries to pin David against the wall with a spear. In the palace itself, Saul attempts to take David's life. And it wasn't the first time, but it was kind of the last straw. Saul's attempt to kill David pushes David away from the palace, away from Saul, and he immediately becomes an outlaw. Reminds me a little bit of Robin Hood. I don't think David stole it, stole from the rich and gave to the poor, but he becomes an outlaw. He has to go out on his own, but he does have his band of merry men, so that's kind of a neat part of it. But David's out on his own, and he's a threat to Saul's dynasty. He's a threat to the things that Saul wants out of his kingdom. And so David runs away, and he takes his trusted men with him, but he runs away and flees from Saul and his army, living on the land, keeping those that are faithful to him close. And for quite a while, that's how he lives. As we jump ahead then, in our text then, though, into 1 Samuel 24, we see another glimpse at their story, at their interaction. There are things that happen, obviously, in between 18 and 24, but we kind of get a neat glimpse into David's response to Saul and another interaction that they have. And so in verse 1 of chapter 24, we read that Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, and he was told that David is in the desert of En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 able young men from Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. And like I said, the Philistines and the Israelites are just going to constantly be going back and forth. They almost always seem to have animosity towards one another. And just here and there, they'll have battles. They'll lose a little land. They'll gain a little land. And just kind of this constant struggle. But what we see here is that someone spots David. And after one of these battles, even though they're tired, even though they've just finished a bloody battle, Saul is so bent on finding David, so bent on getting to David, that he doesn't care how his men feel, that doesn't care if they're tired or exhausted or how he feels. He's going to pursue him. He's going to set out after them. And so he pursues him to this dry, rocky, deserty kind of place. There's lots of caves and lots of crevices and cracks, and it kind of overlooks the Mediterranean. It's on the kind of on the coast there. And so there's lots of there's pockets of water, of oasis is kind of a thing, but a lot of it's dry and rocky and cavernous. And so we see Saul pursue him there. And then we also know, though, we can probably assume from the text that as Saul pursues, someone lets David know that Saul's on his way. David has his own scouts. David has his own people going out, and Saul know, or the scout lets David know that Saul's on his way. And so instead of running away, instead of trying to escape, they decide they're going to hide. And there's lots of good hiding places in this area. And so they probably divide up. He's probably got several men. Then they divide up into different caves, into different areas, and they hide. So we read in verse 3 that as Saul came to the sheep pens along the way, a cave was there. And Saul went in to relieve himself. And David and his men were far back in the cave. So this is why we read our text, right? This is why we read our Bibles, because there's fascinating things that come up. Lots of fun, interesting details that you don't expect to be in God's Word, but there they are. And it's really fun, especially if you know junior hires. They like this kind of stuff. And so it gets them interested in it. But there's an interesting turn of events here. An interesting turn of events that as Saul is pursuing David, you know, even kings have the call of nature, right? Everybody responds to that and has to do that and take care of those things. And so as Saul decides and takes care of business, he goes in to this cave by himself into the darkness. And David and his men are back further. But you think about it, what are the odds? What are the odds of that happening? And there's a Cubs joke in there somewhere, I'm pretty sure. I don't know what it is. You can come up with your own. But this might be their year, isn't that? But we say that every year, don't we? Anyway, so there's a Cubs joke. There might be a Vikings joke for me, too, in there. It was a rough week for me as a Vikings fan, too. But well, like I said, could be their year. I think we say that every year, though, Nicole. So anyway, what are the odds of this happening? What are the odds that Saul picks the same cave that David and his men are in? The fact that he goes in by himself, that it's a dark cave, that he can't see what's going on for at least a while, that he puts himself in obviously a very vulnerable position in what is the task that he has to accomplish here. But it's just amazing odds. The fact that David and his men are back further in the cave, they can kind of see in the cave, they can see the light coming in, they could tell it was Saul, they could see clearly that it was him. What are the odds? And so if we look at this, for those of us in this room, I think most of us would say this has to be a God moment. This has to be an opportunity that God designed and put into David's path. God delivered and provided David's enemy right to him. So in verse 4, we see David's men's reaction to this. David's men said, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he told you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish.'" And so imagine the picture, right? Saul's men, thinking outside the cave, Saul's men are standing there waiting. They see Saul go in, right? Going to give him the privacy. They see Saul go in. And David's men in their mind are imagining this. As Saul's men are standing there waiting, they see Saul go in, but who do they see come out? I can just imagine the background music. I can imagine the image that they see is in slow motion. David's hair is waving in the breeze as David steps out of them. All of this awe and this amazing image of they thought Saul was coming out, but here is David. And chariots of fire is what I thought of too, so that works well. But David comes out, And he holds up, and this is a little gross, but holds up Saul's head. And David's men are just imagining this. They're excited, and they're ready to conquer and take over and allow David to be king. But then we read the text. That's good, Tom. Thank you. Then we read the text that as this image of David conquering comes to mind, we think and wonder, is this really what's going to happen? It's this mentality where no one's going to blame him. No one's going to blame David. No one's going to call him unjust. Really, he's acting out of self-defense. David or Saul's been pursuing him, tried to kill him numerous times. This mentality of do unto others as he intends to do unto me, which isn't biblical, by the way, but this mentality of do unto others as he intends to do unto me would have been a cultural thing ingrained in them. If I don't get him first, he's going to get me. And so as David approaches Saul, I think he has every intention of coming up behind him and doing him in. Quick and painless, and it's all over. And so we see in verse 4, as he approaches Saul, he slowly comes up to him. Saul isn't any the wiser, but something dawns on David. Something dawns on David, that he is about to make his mess messier. He's about to take this story where really he's done nothing wrong, and he's going to fix it his way. And if you imagine later on, years down the road, David's sitting and he's got his grandkids around him, and his grandkids run up and say, Grandpappy, Grandpappy, I don't know why they call him that, but Granddaddy, Granddaddy, what did you do? How did you become king? Tell us the story again. And David, in his southern drawl, because he's from southern Israel, I think, so David, in his southern drawl, says, you know, kids, I can't do a southern drawl, so we'll just do it like this. So, you know, kids, your great-grandpappy, well, he was out to get me. You know, I couldn't do anything, I wasn't doing anything wrong, I did everything I could right, and he comes up, and he comes, tries to get me, and all these kind of things, and, you know, I just had this opportunity, I had this chance. I should quit trying to do voices. I had this chance that he was going potty, because he's talking to the kids, so he's going to use that. And, he's going to the potty, and I got up there, and I was able to come up to him, and I was able to. And that would be his story. It would be the story he'd have to tell his kids and his grandkids, the story he'd have to tell Saul's daughter, his wife. And that would be his story, because every mess comes with some really bad options. Every mess comes with some really bad options. And so what does David do? As he slowly approaches, I think all those things come to mind, his wife and his kids and the story that he have to tell his people. And so he comes up fully intending, I think, initially to do Saul in. But it says in verse 4 that he just cuts off the corner of his robe, of Saul's robe. In verses 5 and 6, it says, David was conscience-stricken after having cut off the corner of his robe. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lay my hand on him, for he is the Lord, anointed of the Lord." His consciousness and his conscience kicks in. His conscience kicks in. As he approaches, he remembers all of these things. He thinks of all of the things that will happen, the story that he's going to have to tell. And then even after cutting off the robe, he feels guilty. He feels remorse for even just cutting off the corner of the robe, and there's some cultural things that are happening there. But ultimately, he realizes he needs to tell a different story. In a culture that's bloody, in a culture that is kind of a tit-for-tat kind of a mentality, eye-for-an-eye mentality, David chooses to let Saul walk away. And in verses 7 and following here, it says, "And Saul left the cave and went his way. But then David went out of the cave, and he called out to Saul, 'Woohoo!'" And he's holding that robe and waving that robe around. Okay, he says, "My lord the king." I think it's more fun. I think it'd be more fun if he said woohoo, but he says, "My lord the king." And then when Saul looked behind him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. This image of respect, this image of honor. really a vulnerable position that he puts himself in before Saul. And in verse 10, he says, this is the day, David is speaking, David says, this is the day that you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not lay a hand on my Lord because he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, look at the piece of robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but I did not kill you. See that there is nothing in my hand to indicate that I am guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me to take my life. May the Lord judge between you and me. David the Merciful. A few verses later, Saul responds in 17. He says, you, David, are more righteous than I. You have treated me well, but I have treated you badly. And I would challenge Saul on that's a really poor word, I think. I think it's a little bit more than badly. But, and then Saul leaves. He returns home, and David goes up with his men to a stronghold. And if we read the rest of Saul's story, if we look ahead, Saul eventually does lose his throne, a random arrow in kind of a random battle. Saul is killed. And then David is able to come to the throne to become Israel's next king. And so it is with most of the messes in our world. The messes that you find yourselves in, the mess that I find myself in, is that most messes are the result of a breakdown in virtue. Now, we don't use that word a whole lot anymore, but virtue being this idea of integrity, of patience, of love, of self-control. Most messes, if not all messes, are the result of that breakdown in virtue. And in fact, if we ignore virtue long enough, eventually we're going to fall into a mess. And then we'll have those options, and a lot of them bad options, to deal with. And then those bad choices are further failures in virtue that lead to even a messier mess. Cleaning a flood with water. Cleaning up paint with more paint. And so looking at David's story, we see all these bad options. If we look at those and we ask the questions, well, would he have been justified? Would David have been justified to kill Saul? After Saul tries to kill him over and over, I think we'd all say, well, yeah, it's justified. Would it have been expected? Culturally especially, it would have been. After those things are all happening, it would have been expected in that culture, especially maybe even in the terms of self-defense. But ultimately, would his choice have been virtuous? It would have been like cleaning a mess with another mess. Because every mess comes prepackaged with bad options. So as we close this morning, the question I want to leave with all of us, as we close our series, as we look at our messes, the question I want to leave with all of us is, what story do I want to tell? What story do you want to tell? You know, the current mess that we're in, when we're in a mess, right, we have this thing going on and this thing going on and that person doing this, and so the mess looks so big, and we've got to, you know, if we're telling somebody about what's going on, we have a, you know, an hour or two or three or four or a week worth of things to tell them about what's going on. But not too long down the road, a few months, a year, 2 years, 5 years down the road, we a lot of times can reduce our mess to one or two sentences. 5 years ago, we got divorced. 2 years ago, we declared for bankruptcy. 6 months ago, I had to drop out of school. And so if those messes get reduced to one or two sentences, the story that gets told, the story that gets retold, is really our response to that mess. We know that David eventually became the greatest king of Israel, but he didn't have to tell his wife, he didn't have to tell his kids or his grandkids that he attained the throne by sneaking up behind Saul and doing him in. He was David the humble, David the merciful, and he won the affections of his people. And so what story do we want to tell? Which of my options do I want as a permanent part of my story? Which option is justified? Which option is expected? Which option is virtuous? So when we ask those questions, when we answer them, we say, well, yeah, it's sure it's justified. Yes, it's expected. But is it virtuous? And those are the stories we want to tell. Those are the stories we want to live. Heavenly Father, we thank you that even if it's buried down deep, even if it's something that isn't clear to us, there is a good, virtuous, God-honoring option available. It's probably the hardest option out there. But we know that that is the best way out of the mess. The least messiest way out of our mess. And we just pray that we can allow you to lead us down that. We pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen. So this morning as we worship team comes forward, as we stand and we sing and have an opportunity to respond, I just encourage, if you need prayer, if you have a decision to make this morning, that you take the time, take that step and come forward this morning. So let's stand. We're going to sing our invitation hymn this morning.